Well, I'm a little concerned that people are going to start going down to Little Trinity to hear that preaching. Steal my flock. That's okay. How impressive was that? What a beautiful, powerful presentation. Yeah. To everybody online, we see you and thank you for being here with us. Time for some question and answer.
You posted some stats on how many ballistic missiles for various countries, etc. I wonder how, I really don't understand what kind of damage each of those units can do. So I wonder how relevant it is to look at those individual things or look at how many when any one of them could perhaps affect everybody.
I want to make sure I'm understanding your question right. Can you give me one more sentence just so I know how to speak to what you're saying?
I guess I just feel a little bit that I really don't understand that piece of it at all, and I wonder if I even need to. I guess I'm asking you to clarify what an individual ballistic missile unit can do in terms of destruction. I know it's not a technical talk, no, but it will help.
So I can answer that generally. Back when I was more versed in the technical stuff, I could have given you a more satisfactory answer. I mean, one nuclear weapon can't destroy the whole world. So what a nuclear weapon does, I should have led with this. What a nuclear weapon does is it causes an explosive chain reaction in what's called fissile material. That's either uranium or plutonium. There are basically two ways of making a nuclear weapon. One is to fire a bullet of fissile material into a solid mass of fissile material, and the other is to create an explosion that makes a fissile material hyper-compressed. Those two ways cause a reaction in which the energy in the matter is released. Depending on the size of the bomb and how the warhead and how effective it is, how well it's made, so how much of the potential energy of the mass is used in an explosive way, drives how destructive it is. So the weapons that were used on Hiroshima and Nagasaki are the size of the detonating device on modern nuclear weapons. That said, the most explosive or the most powerful nuclear weapons ever developed are not in anybody's arsenal today. The Soviet Union did the Tsar Bomba test in 1961. The blast radius was recorded going around the world 5 times, like it was detectable going around the world, and it shattered windows 200 miles away. But that's not most nuclear weapons today. So most nuclear weapons today are going to be somewhere between Hiroshima and Tsar Bomba, and there are places where you can go online. I think it's you could Google bomb maps, and they will show you the yield. But you're looking at, say, roughly of a half mile to a quarter mile radius of almost complete fatality, say with an average-sized nuclear weapon.
But with some lasting resonance.
So then the first thing that goes is heat, and then a blast radius that destroys everything, and then there's, of course, radiation in everything, which is what poisons things. Now, radiation in the air dissipates pretty quickly, but if the radiation, which is why when a bomb explodes high in the air, the radiation effects are not as long term. But if a bomb explodes close to the ground, it irradiates the material and shoots it up into the mushroom cloud. And then that can spread. And that can spread to, I mean, it's not like the blob. It's not going to kill everyone who comes into contact with it. There are varying degrees of radiation exposure and ways of how much you're going to be exposed or not. But I guess what I'm dancing around is that there's no simple way to answer your question, because the yield of modern nuclear weapons is variable. A lot of them, you can even dial it on the warhead to change it for a different circumstance. But you are Yes, what you are concerned about is an explosive radius of blast and heat that is far more than any conventional weapon ever built. And the uncontrollable effects of radiation, which vary greatly depending on what the bomb irradiates in exploding and wind patterns. So once you have a lot of nuclear weapons used, then you potentially have a lot of irradiated material that are casting a pretty significant fallout zone. I think nuclear weapons are irretrievably wicked, but I also want to be realistic about them. People wondered if anything would ever grow again in Hiroshima. It's a thriving city today. It's not radioactive to visit Hiroshima right now. So they're not, I think there's a certain dose of realism is not sort of seeing them as, you know, one bomb is the apocalypse.
Yeah. Other questions?
Tyler, as you know, your passion converts us all. You talked about call up MPs to sign the treaty to ban on nuclear weapons, and maybe I wasn't listening carefully. Who originated the ban? When was it signed, and how many have signed? Spent a half a minute exploring that, what on earth the ban on nuclear weapons is.
The ban treaty was negotiated in the early part, the first part of this year. Of 2017. It was negotiated in the United Nations by the countries that elected to be part of those negotiations. I do not have the exact number of how many participated in those negotiations. It was the text of the treaty was completed on July 7th, and it was open for signatures and ratification in September. We have someone here who could answer this much better than I can. No pun intended, I can. So that's why they named it that. Okay. You learned something new, folks. I don't know is there anything you'd want to fill out in that, Phyllis?
122 nations adopted the treaty.
And that's significant. And it came to pass because there were determined citizens all around the world who said, we've had it. We've had it, and we're not going to take it any longer. The big boys say we need their toys, they need their toys, and we say no. And we say no because we understand with our hearts how utterly cruel and wicked nuclear weapons were for the people of Hiroshima, to which I've been into Nagasaki twice. And now 53 nations have signed it, but only three have ratified it. And it's up to us to do the work that will see those weapons on the way to being banned, on the way to being eliminated after being banned. And Mr. Trudeau's argument is based on the notion that you have to get rid of them, fine, but first you must ban them, and that's how we got rid of landmines. And maybe I'll speak later.
Thank you, Phyllis. I would add the request for Canada to sign the treaty is not an innocuous one, because Canada is part of NATO, and NATO is a nuclear alliance, and so a lot of work would then be entailed with how do you square participation in NATO with this commitment to not be protected by nuclear weapons. So asking the government to sign the treaty is asking them to take on a whole heck of a lot of work, but the alternative is to do the work in advance. And what I think is the genius of the treaty is it's a runaround. What I was presenting is I described the importance of the NPT. The NPT signatories will still point to it as say, this is the road to zero. We're going to, you know, step by step within this. The counter argument is, you're not actually moving toward zero. It's that's not actually an avenue that leads where we want. And so, what I think the genius of the ban treaty is that it creates a norm, an international norm, that then becomes a leverage point to work within nations, whether or not they are supportive of it. So, other questions.
Can you speak briefly about the risks of an accidental nuclear exchange?
I can speak at length about it. I don't know if I can speak briefly. No, I can try. In terms of like pure percentages, it's really hard to say. The fact is that the U.S. and Russia maintain a launch on warning policy that's inherited from the Cold War. And the rationale for this policy is that a surprise attack could, if targeted at our ground-based intercontinental ballistic missiles, could remove a country's ability to retaliate. And so the operating procedure has been that on warning of an attack, that we will launch our missiles so that they can't be detonated in the ground, and so that's the posture. So at any given time, there's roughly a 30-minute window hanging over the world in which the missiles could be in the air right now because of a computer error or what, and we wouldn't know. That takes about 15 minutes to cross the world. The U.S. and Russia are really the only ones to worry about in this regard. I mean, France and the U.K. maintain an active launch posture as well, but they have submarines, which are much more protected. Nuclear submarines are basically invincible. I mean, for all intents and purposes. There have been a number of accidents throughout the history of the U.S. and the Soviet Union and then Russia. We lost this year a man named Stanislav Petrov, who in the early 80s was a launch officer in the Soviet forces, who got the alert that the U.S. had launched nuclear weapons at the Soviet Union. And if he had passed on that command or that data, it would have certainly resulted in the order to launch back. And he didn't. He just elected not to because he thought this can't be real. And he was the subject of a documentary called The Man Who Saved the World. And there's something to that. Bill Perry, the former Secretary of Defense from the United States, vividly tells the story of being woken up at 3 in the morning by a launch officer who said, "My computer is showing 200 Soviet missiles coming at the United States right now." Talk about burying the lead, because then he said, "But it's a computer error." Like, you know, you could start with that. What I'm about to tell you is a computer. Anyway, what he had realized was that someone the previous shift had left the training tapes in, as opposed to the whatever tapes. And so as a result, but he was savvy enough to sort of look at the situation and realize, but there have been a number of times when we have come to the brink of the system being tested and only been protected by humans. There have been mistakes. A flock of geese has been mistaken by radar as the rising of the moon. Thanks, Canada. As nuclear weapons, the rising of the moon has been detected as a nuclear launch. So there are all sorts of instances of accidental exchange, and unfortunately the postures, the command and control postures that would correct that would give some decision-making time, have not been implemented.
Hi, Tyler.
Hi.
Hi. Can you comment on a country's use of nuclear energy and the relationship to the future development of nuclear weapons? I don't know if there is a relationship there. Thank you.
There doesn't have to be, but there can be. So I'm, like I said, really not, like in so many ways, not a nuclear scientist. But the same technology that's used to produce, to enrich nuclear material, like you can find uranium in the ground, right? But it's not actually good for nuclear purposes unless you enrich it so that the radioactive isotope occupies a certain percentage of the material. At a certain percentage, it's good for producing nuclear energy. At a very high percentage of enrichment, it's usable for producing nuclear weapons. Plutonium is usable at all levels for producing nuclear weapons. So Japan, which has a lot of plutonium, could be a nuclear weapons state within months if they chose. That might be like a long estimate. They've got the wherewithal to produce it if they want. So a good deal of this goes on people's sort of evaluation of nations' conduct, of their sense of they're acting, they're not trying for this. But there are probably 20-odd countries around the world that are what are called potential nuclear weapons states that have the capacity to break out in a very short order if they if they so chose. This is what was alarming to people about Iran's behavior, that they had a nuclear energy program, which by treaty right they're perfectly entitled to, but they weren't behaving the way that you would think good faith members of the treaty would behave, and so their motives were a bit muddy. Does that address?
You said that indigenous people around the world have borne the brunt of much of the nuclear testing. Could you say more about that?
This is one of the things that has come out of the humanitarian impact discourse, that it has looked at the legacy of testing and who's been subject to that. And perhaps unsurprisingly, nuclear weapons testing is the ultimate sort of NIMBY issue, right? Nobody wants it in their backyard. And so countries that have done it to the people who are least able to protest it. So at the conference in Vienna, which I attended, it was notable, and the most meaningful moment of the conference, in my view, was a panel discussion of a woman from Australian Aboriginal communities, a woman from the Marshall Islands, and then a Mormon woman from Utah, who's not indigenous, who all talked about the ways in which their communities had been devastated by the legacy of testing and the impact on reproduction and on childbearing and on the capacity of the earth to carry crops is perhaps the most devastating. So this is not, again, I'm giving a bit of an extension to it because the Utah population was not indigenous, but they were poor and they were religious minorities. And the U.S. government quite consciously decided not to test when the wind was blowing south toward Vegas, and yes, to test when the wind was blowing east toward the Mormon cow farmers. And the radiation that's in a nuclear fallout is cesium, is especially susceptible to going into the ground in the form of water and rain. It comes up in grass. The cows eat the grass, it's hyper-concentrated in the milk, and you get entire communities where nobody doesn't get cancer. Everybody gets cancer. In the Marshall Islands, the particularly devastating consequence on that community, which is definitely an indigenous community, was the development of what were called jellyfish babies, where women started, I'm quoting here, delivering babies that looked like bunches of grapes that were born without bones, and which died within a day or two of being born. I think similar phenomena were, when she said that, the woman from Utah and the woman from Australia nodded. That particular aspect of it is of the humanitarian discourse is not something that I have any substantive personal knowledge of, but something that I have observed of it. So I can't go into greater depth than that, but that's at least a gesture toward. And I know that the prioritization of indigenous communities has been front and center in the humanitarian discourse and in the ban treaty negotiations in a way that it just does not happen in the rest of the nuclear security apparatus. I've never seen a panel that was all women and mostly indigenous. It just doesn't happen.
Thank you so much. I know there's more questions. I'm sorry, but we are at time, and we do have staff here that need to wrap up, including myself. Just kidding. Thank you so much, everyone, for coming, and it's been such a delight to be together and get to exchange ideas and to hear more about and learn about and think about what would it mean to be people of peace and to take up the prophetic call that Tyler charged us all with. So I know I learned so much tonight, and I'm so thankful to you. And side note, I'm a printmaker in my side life. And I went upstairs and I said, oh, I need to have a print to give Tyler to thank him for his talk. So I went through my box of leftovers and I found one of my prints and I said, oh, I'll give him this one. And it says Memento Mori on it, which I thought was really interesting. So thank you, you know, for reminding us all that we are dust and to dust we return, and that it is our charge to honor the sacredness of life and to protect that. So thank you for your time.
Thank you.